And we are so delighted to be joined on the phone right now by Bob Harris. He is author of the recently published The International Bank of Bob. It's about the world of microfinance through the lens of a travel memoir. He's had a diverse career as a TV writer, a TV and radio personality, and political humorist, and he's appeared on Jeopardy 13 times. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Really appreciate it. Well, I have to say, one of my colleagues here at the radio station lent me this book, and A, I couldn't put it down, and B, in the middle of the book, I jumped up and ran to my computer and made some microloans. It's a very compelling story. I was especially fascinated by what you were doing, you know, when you decided to start making microloans. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you came to the decision?
Yeah, sure. And for the benefit of listeners who may not be familiar with microloans,
yes, thank you.
Just making financial tools available to the working poor around the developing world in the same way that, you know, we need credit cards and a checking account and just to function and get by. One approach to helping people in poverty rather than aid, which, you know, certainly has its place. It's very important. But a lot of times, I mean, it's different from giving a person a fish or teaching a person to fish. These are people who already know how to fish. But when you live on $3 a day, you can't, if you have a hole in your rowboat and you need to repair it, you can't go to Citibank for a bridge loan. You need a smaller amount of money. You probably don't have credit if you're a Bangladeshi farmer. And so just simply making money available to people at low interest rates, it turns out that people at the bottom end of the economic spectrum, that's just where they were born. They're as creative and as resourceful and certainly as hardworking and often much more. As you or me, the loans pay back really, really reliably. Well, I didn't know any of this, and I was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I had lucked into a job as a luxury travel writer living the life of a billionaire, traveling around the world. I was actually paid my job. I mean, and mind you, I grew up working class in Ohio. My dad worked for General Motors for 37 years. My favorite food's Cheerios. I'm working class and will be my whole life. I lucked into this job, and all of a sudden, I'm in the south of France. And I'm eating food I can't pronounce, and I'm getting paid to write these articles for Forbes, for their luxury travel website, ForbesTraveler.com. Basically, they were picking the hotels. I just had to show up and confirm that the beds were soft. That was my job. I got paid, and so this sounds like a dream gig, and it kind of was for a while. But if you do that in the south of France, that's neat. But if you're in Dubai, or if you're in a lot of other places in the developing world where there are billion-dollar hotels being constructed by people who are much poorer than you and me, they're basically indentured servants, people who are living on $6 a day or something like that, it's really hard to just sleep in that hotel and feel okay about it. You know, I mean, you know, there's just, if you see yourself in other people at all, you just eventually want there to be a certain fairness in the world. And I remember how my dad used to look at the end of really hard days, and there were just some guys in Dubai who reminded me of him, and they wind up taking these jobs so they can send a little bit of it, that $6 a day, they can send three of it home to their family in a country where maybe people make $2 a day in Nepal or South India or whatever. That's actually making a little bit of extra money. So these guys are going through this hell because they love their families, just the same way that my dad loved us. And I couldn't just pocket the money for lucking into this job and being paid to live like a billionaire for a while. I lucked out. How can I use my good fortune to help other people? I did a bunch of research and kind of stumbled across microlending and realized that this was something that I thought might work. And invested some money into it and then wanted to go see if it did work and went out to see it in the field. And the book is sort of the memoir of those stories.
Mm-hmm. So you went out and invested through Kiva, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, Kiva.org, and anybody listening to this, just go to the website, Kiva, K-I-V-A. It's a lending platform. Some folks in the Bay Area put together. And it works an awful lot like eBay or Craigslist or any of those things where you can go and you see listings. Only in this case, rather than, you know, crap in somebody's garage or, you know, whatever you might find on eBay, it's actually people who describe the work they're doing and the reason they need the loan. Maybe it's a farmer in Kenya who is financing a dairy cow. And that actually works incredibly well, by the way. They finance dairy cows as an asset that they can then, you know, they can sell the milk at a profit and use that to pay off the loan. Then the cow's paid off and they've got income free and clear. They can do that the same way that we would borrow money to pay for a car that we would use as a taxi. It's sort of the same idea. And there's these really amazingly creative ideas where people, you know, and it's clinics and schools, and sometimes it's just somebody's grocery or whatever. You can go through and pick somebody of your choice and say, well, I could see, you know, I'll find that guy $25 for a few months. And you just, it's as easy to use as any of those other sites. It's all rigged up with PayPal. So without leaving your laptop, you can just, you know, sit down or use your iPad or whatever, and $25 comes out of your account and zips off down to Nicaragua or over to the Philippines or something, and a few months later you get paid back about 99% of the time. It's incredibly cool. You feel like a little foundation. You get to help people all over the world.
It is incredibly cool. I really enjoyed going to that site about halfway through your book. I went to the site and looked at it, and just looking at all the people and, you know, the photos of them and their stories about what they needed and why, and it was fascinating. I just thought it was really, really terrific. And at the beginning of your book, when you talk about, you know, the luxury travel review you were doing, I don't know what you would call it. I call it kind of a big squirm factor reading it, how much money was wasted, you know?
It's so unbelievable.
It was just really interesting to see how you bounced from that to taking the money you made writing about that to lending it to people.
I think that squirm factor, that feeling of, you know, sometimes money just is, you know, when it's just sitting in, you know, giant Swiss bank accounts, and there's just, you know, billions sitting around the world that are maybe just locked up in these billion-dollar hotels that, you know, aren't even full, often, some of the Emirates or whatever. I think there is a real squirm factor. The fact that I was there participating in that, and then right outside the door were people who were, you know, really struggling and working 12-hour days in 105-degree heat. I think that was the vice that clamped down on my heart hard enough personally that I just felt like, okay, I have to do things differently. The thing is, we see it all in our daily lives anyway on a smaller scale. I mean, I live in Los Angeles. We certainly have rich and poor here. And I'm sure listeners here, you know, there's rich and poor everywhere in America. You know, I had my eyes opened because I had my face shoved right into it where it's most intense. But a lot of people, I think, as they read the book, they realize, you know, if you live in New York or you live, you know, in a small town near an Indian reservation or whatever, there's rich and poor everywhere in this country. And we start realizing, hey, wait a minute, you know, a lot of this is the birth lottery. A lot of times people are born rich, they're born poor. But people who just had the bad luck of being born poor, there's no reason that those of us who are lucky enough at least to be in the middle, if it's not costing as much, of course we can help them. You know, they're just like us.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Bob Harris. He is the author of the recently published The International Bank of Bob. Well, Bob, it sounds like from your career as a writer and TV and radio person and so forth, that it was sounds like a perfect fit that you would then take that experience and travel and write a book about it. So what was it like to visit the actual people that you'd made loans to all over the world?
It was incredible, primarily because I kept expecting that things would be really, really different in places. I thought when I landed in Bosnia or when I showed up in Lebanon or when I wound up in, you know, I figured that the world would seem immensely different everywhere I went. And of course it does on a superficial level. There's different languages and religions and customs and all that. And you got to be able to navigate that stuff. But after a little while, if you've traveled enough and you spend enough time with enough different people, you know, everybody is just trying to feed their kids. Everybody's just trying to put food on the table, make a better life for their kids. I don't care if you're in Peru or you're in Nicaragua or wherever you are. That's all anybody's trying to do. And we think of that as the American dream. It's the human dream. It's something everyone does. And stuff like languages and cultures, and that all started to feel like a really thin coat of paint that you could just scratch off with a fingernail. And I can tell you, to a shocking degree, my experience was, you know, whether I was in Eastern Europe or Southeast Asia or wherever, after a while, when you start seeing people that way, all the other stuff just stops being relevant. And the whole notion of elsewhere started just disappearing. And that was what was really staggering and what I really wanted to communicate in the book. I hope that when people read the book, by the end, they really feel that kind of surprising connection to places that you would never imagine feeling that kind of connection to.
Well, not only a connection in a human way when, you know, the stories of what, you know, what people's lives were like and their families and what were they were trying to do with their families, but also the technology and the fact that all over the developing world, cell phones and ATMs, and that was sort of amazing to me.
Oh, it is breathtaking. You can go to East Africa, and in Kenya, they have mobile banking that's vastly more sophisticated than ours. I mean, it's stunning. I mean, people do their transactions just with their cell phones. They type in a couple of codes, and boom, I bought that banana from you, or, you know, whatever. Any transaction we want to do, we just whip out the phone and get it done. You see this throughout the book, I hope. There's constant surprises in terms of just how not third-worldy the third world often is. I mean, if you watch the news, the world outside America's borders and outside of Western Europe is sort of this poor, violent place, because that's all we see. We only see those parts of the world when something blows up or there's a war declared or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, I'm showing up in Cambodia and the hotel feels just like an American hotel, and the people I'm meeting are, yeah, they have different languages and customs and whatever, but they've got their cell phones out, and we're connecting as a species. I mean, humanity worldwide is starting to connect with this internet in a way that was unimaginable when I was a kid, and I find immense hope in that, mm-hmm. as Kiva demonstrates. I mean, anybody listening to this can go to kiva.org, and literally within 15 minutes, you can help finance somebody in, I think there are up to 68 countries all over the world. And it's boom, it's done. Your money starts going, and you can get that done. That just could not have existed 10 years ago. It's amazing.
Whoever came up with this idea, was it Kiva, or was it a different micro-lending platform actually won the Nobel Prize?
Uh-huh. Right. The Nobel Prize went, actually it was to a micro-lending bank in Bangladesh.
Oh, the Grameen bank? Okay.
Yeah. And it's the founder, Muhammad Yunus. And they're the actual lenders. They're folks, you know, who actually are going into the villages and bringing financial tools and education to people. What Kiva is as a web platform is sort of the go-between you and the lenders in the field. They have field partners in 68 countries. And so the chain basically goes from, you know, you sit at your laptop and the money passes through Kiva, dips off to the lending institution. And then the lending institution in the field works with the client. And when the client repays, it's like a bucket brigade. It comes right back to you.
Mm-hmm. Bob, was there any place that you went that you felt, oh, gosh, This is a little scary, or I don't feel terribly welcome here?
You know, I have to tell you, now, don't get me wrong. There are places in the world I certainly didn't visit. I didn't parachute into any active war zones. I didn't, you know, there's plenty of places. There were places I didn't go because I have common sense. I didn't go to the Eastern Congo. I didn't go to Iraq. And there is a Kiva partner in Iraq. So I might have had different experiences had I gone to a few of those places. There's only about a couple dozen places like that on Earth, by the way. But there were a lot of places I went to where my experience was actually, you know, I landed at the airport with some genuine dread and then had nothing but delight. Beirut. I mean, freaking Beirut, all right? I'm a kid from Ohio. I don't speak Arabic. I don't have any friends in Beirut. And I just bought a plane ticket and, you know, read the newspapers and made sure that, you know, things were relatively calm at the moment. I went to Beirut and buddied up to, I had made contact with a local field partner, a lending institution there called Al Majmua, and they spoke some English. And I showed up at the hotel, went over, walked through Beirut over to Al Majmua, and I never ran into the slightest hostility of any kind while I was there. All I ran into was kind of friendliness, warmth, and a huge welcome. It was like, you know, thank you for coming. You know, what are you doing? Wait, you're an American and you're wandering around Beirut by yourself? What? You must be teaching English. You must have a job here. You must be an executive. You know, they figured I had a business thing there A lot of times they just took me to be a European or something. I never once had the slightest moment of concern or fear. I was ready to, but it just never happened. It might be a little different right now with the conflict going on in Syria. You know, Lebanon is, you know, right next door there, and it's a slightly different circumstance. So I don't mean to be Pollyanna about this to people or take any of this lightly. I'm just telling you that was my experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that was one of the things I found so heartening about the book was that you did seem to visit a huge variety of areas and kinds of places and didn't run into a whole lot of negative experiences and in fact had really great experiences, which is leads me to, I know that you met one gentleman who said a 5-word phrase to you that really stuck with you, and I was hoping you would share that with our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. That actually was in Lebanon. It's kind of a nice segue. And the book does wind up kind of being purely by accident a travelogue through recent war zones, you know, with Rwanda and whatnot. But I just kept having the same experience. And while I was in Lebanon, to sort of set this up, he asked me to do a little quick reading. I'm going to read one page from the book here, give you the flavor of it. I was in the middle of visiting clients, and the lender, Al Najmoa, would assign I'd ride along with a field officer who was going out to meet clients, sort of the same way that maybe a crime writer might ride along with a cop, you know, as they go around to cases in the course of the day. So I was riding around with a loan officer, and that loan officer actually said what I consider the most memorable thing I heard in Lebanon and honestly maybe in my life. This guy, and I call him Ahmed in the book, he didn't always work for Al Najmoa, but he enjoys it there very much. And the way that he said it to me in his broken English was, "It's good, everyone equal, like family, Christian, Muslim, everyone loved the same, you know?" And we're riding in the car, and the three tenors are playing on the radio as he tells his story, which is clear and even through his English. And I ask God to bless my family. I'm a rich man, beautiful wife. He's got 2 young daughters, and for 16 years, he had a large, popular restaurant. Stayed out of politics, you know, like a lot of people everywhere. He's just trying to make a living, just trying to put food on the table. And his restaurant flourished, welcoming clients of all faiths. Shia, Sunni, all the same, he says. Television splits us. Politics. People love God, love each other, all the same. By the way, whenever he said the word God, he was pointing at his own heart. He wasn't trying to talk about any specific God. He was just trying to talk about love that lives in all of us. But in July 2006, Hezbollah unilaterally launched rocket strikes against Israel, and they kidnapped Israeli soldiers near the border, and that touched off an escalating conflict that eventually led to Israeli air attacks on Beirut itself. And in one of those strikes, Ahmed's restaurant was destroyed. So it was his livelihood. Now, fortunately, his family was all right. But through no fault of his own, his whole living, his home, his way of life was all gone. So now, Ahmed works as a loan officer at Al Najmoa. He's rebuilding his own life while trying to help others do the same. And to put his daughters through school, he also has to work on weekends. But now in somebody else's restaurant, he waits tables, he, you know, greets people. It's a huge step down. So in the car, I asked if he was bitter. You know, going from being the owner of the restaurant to just being a hired hand, if that made him angry at the Israelis, at Hezbollah, at God, at whoever. No, he said. Everything is clear for me. When my God is with me, I don't care about something like that, no. And he didn't pause here while speaking, but in my memory he did, because I thought about the next 5 words he said every day of my life ever since. You love more, you win. You don't stop, thanks for God. And then he added for emphasis, you love more, you win. I think those 5 words need to be put on bracelets. They need to be spray-painted on walls. I think that's the best thing. This didn't come out of some yoga class in Berkeley. This didn't come out of some ethics or philosophy class or a bunch of people at a university. This was a guy whose life was blown up in the middle of West Beirut. And it was a choice he was making every single day of his life. And it was clearly hard for him, but he could do it. If Ahmed can do that, I can do that. This guy, if you watch the television, this guy is supposed to be our enemy. And he was one of the sweetest people I've ever met in my life. If he can do that, I don't know who can. So that's why the book goes there. That's why that's near the end of the book.
I just love that whole part because that's just indicative of the whole tone of this book, which is optimism and the real resilience of people everywhere.
Yeah, I kept meeting all over the world who had been through things that I would have been driven mad by. And as you read in the book, I constantly asked them, how are you not completely insane? And horrible things people have been through. If you read the book, I won't bother radio listeners with it, but terrible things, you know, tragedies, people being shot, family members. And the answers I got everywhere in the world from people of completely different faiths, cultures, you know, Buddhists in Cambodia and Christians in Rwanda and Muslims in Lebanon and people all over the world. I kept hearing the same exact thing back. And it was the way they took strength from each other, that they loved their families. It's exactly the same things we would imagine, but maybe not even hope that we'd be strong enough to draw on. And everywhere in the world is the same exact answer. The way we cope, the way we deal, the way that we love, it's all the same. And microlending is a really important way for us to come together, and I hope that people will visit Kiva.org after hearing this. But if there's any one message the book really ultimately has, it's that we are the same.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Bob, I want to thank you so much for your time tonight, for joining us and talking about your book. It's truly wonderful, and I do hope our listeners will get a hold of the book and also go to Kiva and take a look at it, because it's just it's a remarkable idea and a remarkable system. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. And if people want more information or they want to grab the book or something, just Google the words Bank of Bob and you'll find it. That's easy enough. I mean, I have a website, it's bobharris.com and all that, but seriously, just Google Bank of Bob and you're good. And Kiva.org, of course, is the charity.
Okay, well, thank you again for your time and all the best in your work.
Thank you so much. Real pleasure talking with you.